giving them the power of the narrative in that die roll moment gives them the power to like sink into their character and figure out like what makes sense here and stay true to both the character and the story.
Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
The Gnomecast, the Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This episode is brought to you by awesome Patreon backers like the amiable Amadea Rosa, the dynamic Doug Ross, and the glamorous Greg Gordon. Today we have me, Ange, along with Jared and Josh, and we are going to talk about how to get your players to dive into role-playing. How do we get them from just telling us what their character does to talking as their character? Before we dive into that main topic, though, we're going to ask our Get to Know a Gnome question. Tell us about one of the most awkward PCs you have ever played.
Okay, I was thinking about this one because, you know, anytime a character is a lot like me, then that's probably one of the most awkward characters that I have ever played. However, in this case, I was thinking more along the lines of I played an angel in a Mutants and Masterminds game named Anariel, and is basically based on Zariel from JLA when they had a literal angel on the team. Except the backstory that I came up with for him is that his job was to sit in heaven and monitor superheroes, and whenever they ran into something supernatural, he was supposed to log it and then send it on down the line for some other angel that was more important to register whether or not they needed to get involved. But he decided he wanted to sneak away and help out. So everyone is thinking that, of course, like he is here as a divine messenger helping them with stuff, and actually he's like sneaking away from his job. I was trying to play him like someone that was basically a clerk that was trying to act like they were a much more important angel than they were.
That's hilarious. He's just sneaking away from his desk job.
I also got to say that I have to consult the tablets, and everyone is thinking like it's an angel on tablets, and I literally just had a tablet.
Josh, what about you?
Kind of on the same lines of fish out of water, I played a character named Bodon in a 13th Age game. And 13th Age lets you do the one unique thing where you can state one unique thing about your character and it is true for the setting. So I stated that he was the first Warforged ever created. But instead of him, it being like a new thing, it's he was created centuries ago. And then, like Captain America, was frozen in the ice, shut down, you know, put to sleep, whatever, and then reawoken in the quote unquote modern day. It was like a medieval-ish setting, so modern is relative, but you know. And he did not understand who all these people were, what all this society was. Like, he grew up in a world of automatons, and now he's thrust into people that have squishy flesh and weird emotions, and he doesn't know how to handle it. And also, because my husband was running this game and he likes to watch me squirm, he had decided that, in fact, this was not the first time that my character had reawoken. He just didn't remember the other times. And so he would run into other characters that he was supposed to know, including his wife. And throughout the entire campaign, every time we'd be like deep in the muck of like the big plot, there would just be like, oh, yeah, and your wife is calling you on the sending stone. Right. Oh, I forgot something that I had a wife. Right. Okay.
See, there for a minute when you're talking about being awake before, I'm thinking, oh, this is some like Winter Soldier stuff here.
Yeah, I guess actually that would probably be a better character.
Same universe, you know, Cap, well, Winter Soldier.
My initial idea for him was Captain America, but then I think my husband heard that and thought, no, Bucky.
For me, there's a few I could talk about, including most recently Kazina, who was in Jared's Marodi campaign. But I am going to talk about Tucker. Tucker was a werewolf in a Monster Hearts one shot. And everyone else, all the other characters were so serious and so mean girls-esque with their characters. I just had to go a different route. The premise of the game was that it was prom night. And so, like, what happens at prom? And I spent the entire game with Tucker trying to figure out how to tell a boy that she liked him while the other characters were scheming and maneuvering. And in the end, the school was burning down, and Tucker rescued her crush from the collapsing gym, and she got to ask him if he wanted to go get burgers. And we had our happy little, you know, teenage ending, walking off down the street as the other characters are nearly killing each other as they set the gymnasium on fire. It was so much fun.
It's the fun side of Carrie.
Moving on into our main topic, we're all here for role-playing games. That is an absolute given. But the depth to which players dive into the role-playing aspect of these games can vary from table to table. Recent conversations about passive players and charismatic characters has made me want to have a chat with my fellow gnomes about what we as GMs can do to encourage our players to get into their characters and role-play. So let's dive in. First up, what does it mean when we say we want our players to role-play? What are the specifics we're talking here?
It depends on what the table's comfortable with from a practical standpoint, from where I'm coming at. But I think what we're trying to dig at here is like getting into character, acting a little more, you know, speaking in character instead of just saying I roll to attack, but taking on the role, the role of the character in the role-playing game.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting because before you kind of made the comment about how do we get them to talk in character? It's like, sometimes I'm not even worried about that. I had a player one time. He was very kind of closed off. He played a lot of like Pathfinder. And when he played Pathfinder, it was very mechanical. He was trying to get, you know, this to work, get really upset when his die rolls didn't work because he did this feat with that spell and it should have done this. And I got him in my DC Adventures game and he didn't talk a lot in person. But he did start framing things from the mindset of his character. He started not just looking at his character saying this power did this and I rolled this, but actually kind of thinking about, okay, if I was a guy that was stationed at the North Pole doing wilderness observation before I got my powers, how would I react to these things? And it was just really, really interesting to see him kind of move more into that mindset where he is at least describing things from the mindset of, I think I would do this because this.
In modern days, kind of the gold standard of what people think of as role-playing is like Critical Role, where you have these professional voice actors acting as their characters and giving you entertainment that is deep storytelling while also still framed around a role-playing game. I don't think any of us here are actually expecting that level of skill and voice acting and role-playing at our tables. But I do want the players to have their characters have conversations with each other that are not just discussing tactics about what to do next and how to do in all the minutia of the game part of our role-playing games. And it is very easy for some games, especially that are a little more gamified, like I get like D&D. It is very easy to play a D&D game without ever acting as your character. You know, you just discuss how your character's traveling through the wilderness with the other players, when you're camping, when you're doing this, you get in the dungeon, I'm checking for traps, and there's these points where there's no role-playing, there's no in-character interactions, and it's the in-character interactions that I really want to see more out of players. I have also had a time where I was running for a group of newbies. I was running for my niece and her friends when they were all still in high school. There wasn't a whole lot of role-playing among them because they were all very new. They're all teens. It's all a little kind of awkward. And it took a little bit to get them to the point. Now, all of them were storytellers. All of them had done their, you know, those of us of a certain age are going to be like, what? But all of them had done their OCs in their RP where they texted each other and all that. All of them had done that. All of them knew how to decide what a character did based on who that character was. But getting that to the table in a role-playing game where you're actually facing everyone can be a little difficult to achieve.
Man, so many thoughts on what you brought up, Ange. And the first thing, like, I think it needs to be said that, like, if like Critical Role, Dimension 20, if those are like the professional sports of role-playing games, then like the majority of us are just playing pickup games. right? Like down at the park or like intramural games at the YMCA,
I'm in the senior league.
and like just as we would not expect, you know, those games to be as involved as like a professional athlete sort of a game, like we shouldn't expect, but that still doesn't mean we can't strive to improve ourselves or reach that level, right? It should be aspirational.
I think there's a lot of people who, like, using your sports metaphor, there's a lot of people, well, why bother playing baseball if I can't play at that level? Well, there's still so much fun and value you can get from playing these games. You know, it's like, it doesn't have to be professional. It doesn't have to be official. It's like, there's so many benefits, the social, the keeping your you know, your body moving. And in role-playing games, your brain moving. You don't have to be at that top tier level to still enjoy it and get value out of it.
I think one of the other things that comes to mind when you were talking about, bringing the kids along for, you know, introducing the youngs to the role playing game and people that had like role played, you know, systemless in the past, but like getting them to actually do it at the table was weird. I think there's something to be said for systematized permission. So like if you're looking at a D&D character sheet, there's nothing on the character sheet that gives you permission to talk in character, to think in character. It's all just stats. Now, like experienced people can look at like an int stat or a wisdom score or whatever the system has and say, oh, okay, so this is roughly the way, you know, this person is probably thinking at or, you know, thinking about or approaching the situation. But for a new person, it's sort of like, that is the bonus to the dice that I roll when I roll dice.
Yeah, very much. Speaking of, what is the tipping point between relying on the player's actions as their character and when we roll the dice?
I mean, I was just thinking about how we were talking about getting people into that mindset to where they're actually thinking about the character and playing the character as opposed to just looking at the numbers and rolling. And I think one of the things that I do like doing once in a while is when somebody says that they do something, just letting it happen instead of forcing the die roll. That being said, there are sometimes when we're talking about brand new people, sometimes they want to roll the dice. That effort of walking them through, like, it's not just because the die said 13. It's because you told me what you were doing was standing up on top of the table and shaking your sword at them. That's why that succeeded. And if you would have rolled lower, we would have said you did that, but something about the situation made it not succeed. It's that whole, like, kind of like slowing down and walking things through step by step, you know, how you get from this point to this point and determine whether or not something actually happened or not.
Josh, your thoughts here?
It's not an easy answer, but the answer that comes to mind is it depends. Like, I mean, there's a lot of quote unquote discourse right now about, you know, just letting someone succeed without rolling a die or something like that, whatever. I think that's a perfectly valid option.
Yes.
Most reasonable people who aren't trying to, you know, create clickbait content, I think would agree that it is a reasonable option for a GM. The stats are there for a reason. Like there is a game component to the role-playing game and you don't want to completely ignore them. And you also don't want to penalize people that don't have like a silver tongue and can't think of the expressive or, you know, quippy or, you know, really cool thing to say in the moment for not being able to do that. You know, you've got a charismatic player and they know how to make like a charming character who knows how to talk to people because they themselves know how to interact with people. And then they turn charisma into their dumb stat. That seems kind of like cheating.
Yes.
And it depends on your table, but for the most part, like it's gotta be backed up by the stats as well. So finding that sweet spot is really, it's something that takes practice and you just got to work at it with your table.
I do think there is the opposite side of this spectrum where I have seen some games where, you know, like if the dice never come into play, I'm also a little disappointed, you know?
Yeah.
Because I've got a character sheet for a reason. I have things on this sheet that I am good at. Please let me roll sneak for Kazina. So I can add plus 17 to the roll just because I get to be a badass in that moment. But it's really like encouraging the players to get into the narrative of what their character is doing in this setting, in this scenario, in this situation, before you call for the dice roll.
One of the things I've been trying to work into my GMing style lately, it's been slow going because I forget all the time, but asking for descriptions after the die roll has been made. So, you know, you get to the point where like, I'm going to go talk to the barkeep. Okay, roll your charisma. Okay, yeah, I got a natural 20. Cool. How do you succeed? Handing it over and letting them take the narrative reins. Or, you know, the opposite. Oh, I biffed that. I only rolled a 2. Okay, how do you fail? Giving them the power of the narrative in that die roll moment gives them the power to like sink into their character and figure out like what makes sense here and stay true to both the character and the story.
Now, I will say that doesn't work at every table. Like I have a player in one of my regular games who, if you do that to him, he freezes. He has trouble engaging on that narrative level at that point, being put on the spot. But I do think getting that description in there, like a lot of times what I will do is I will ask them what their intentions are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what are you trying to do? Like, I get it. You don't want to role play talking to the bartender, but tell me what you're trying to get out of him.
Yeah.
Then we'll get the role out of the way and then we'll just get the description layered over the scene. What I really want is I want them to come up, ask me in character the question, I can respond as the bartender, because I get my role playing on that way too. You know, it's like it's really helpful, but sometimes players aren't at that stage yet. I remember I was running a Dresden Files game at Origins many years ago, and it was an incredibly difficult table to run for because all of the players, all 6 of them, were incredibly passive, and I was having to pull them by their teeth through this adventure to get anywhere with it, because they wouldn't choose to do anything, and I kept having to force them. They're finally in this location. There's a person they're looking for. I describe him at the bar hitting on a woman who looks very disinterested, and this one player who has been like the most passive, obviously inexperienced players, goes, I'm going to go up and start flirting with him so he leaves her alone. I'm like, oh my God, she's going to do something. So I'm like, okay. And she picks up her dice and I'm like, no. Tell me how you approach this and then we'll roll. And she like deer in the headlight eyes. And she's like, I go up to him and say, you need to leave. The cops are looking for you. Everyone else at the table was like, that's not flirting. The whole game was a disaster, but that one moment is like, well, she was trying.
I mean, I think a lot of, especially with new tables or tables that you're trying to draw them out more, like letting them know at the start, just being upfront about it, right? Like, do you want to talk in character and role play with us? Just want to give me a couple bullet points about what you're going to do. Make sure you tell me your intentions here. Like you mentioned, Ange, I think asking for the intentions is very important. Sometimes people in an effort to be cool and subtle are so subtle that they don't actually say anything that the other person can understand and run with. And so like clarifying that is important. But when she got those deer in headlights, like my initial impulse as a GM would have been to be like, not to like nitpick, but you know, the way you handled it or whatever, but just like, I would have been like, okay, so like you can just give me some bullet points. Just give me a couple things that you might like try to do, you know, something like that. Just to try to like pull it back from like this massive thing that she's trying to do to like just something bite size.
There's been times when I still catch myself doing this. We've talked about this on a variety of topics before, but asking a leading question is always going to be easier for someone to deal with than asking something that's completely open-ended. So if you know, say something like, did you do it this way, or did you have something completely different in mind? That starts giving them something to build on instead of just saying what you do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great.
Leading into the next question, what is it we can do to model good role playing from the GM side of the table?
Pretend that you totally intended that merchant to actually have a personality. I think we're beyond the fact where we want people to think the GM knows everything and has everything in the world mapped out. But on the other hand, it is a little bit less satisfying when you say this isn't a real person, just buy your stuff and go. But at the same time, you can almost do the GM side of what we were talking about before, where you're like, this is a really unassuming person. They're very shy. You know, the shop is very simple and all this, and you kind of frame why maybe they don't have as big a personality as, say, a Pumat Soul, to throw Critical Role back into this.
Yeah, when it comes specifically to shopping, my Saturday group has a longstanding, almost 20-year-old rule. We don't do shopping at the table. In one of the very early campaigns we played, we spent an hour and a half shopping because one of the players was searching for these really weird esoteric items, and the GM was role-playing each merchant she was interacting with. And in the end, it turns out what she was searching for was the materials to make a matching costume for her familiar. While that is delightful, the rest of us were just sitting there waiting the entire time. And that kind of brought in the rule, we don't shop at the table. Now, if the players want to use, quote unquote, shopping to go talk to the merchants and find out local information, that's a completely different situation. Getting back to kind of what Jared's original point was, there are times where you just make an NPC up on the fly because the players decided to talk to somebody that you didn't know needed to exist. And sometimes it's okay to say, yeah, this is, you know, a merchant. Are you going to remember his name in 5 minutes? And you don't need to know his name. Sometimes just even role-playing on the GM side of the screen as the NPCs, doing that slight character voice, the different intonations, the, you know, different vocabulary can, like, present to the players a way to act as your character that they can interact with. And sometimes that can be fun. The NPCs they fall in love with are the best.
Trying to remember who that was with Brennan, that they, like, picked out an NPC and started talking to them. It was like, what's his name, Brennan? What's he do? What does he look like? Like, they were intentionally, like, doing that to him.
There's a couple things that I think that GMs can do to help model role-playing. Some systems have this in place. Even the ones that don't, it's easy to put in there. Character motivations. I like to make sure that when I'm setting up for the campaign or the adventure or whatever we're running, that I make sure every player has thought about, and preferably written down and let me know as well so that I can work them into the game, their character's short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And for some people, that triggers managers asking what your five-year plan is. But like, knowing, like, what do you want to get done within, like, the next couple sessions? What do you want to get done within the course of this story arc? And what is, like, the long-term goal that your character is going after? It's so much easier to know how to act and react to situations in character when you know why your character is doing these things. If you don't know why your character would bother going down into the dungeon, then when you try to put in, like, a role-playing scene with an NPC in that dungeon, like maybe it's a, you know, explorer that got lost or something in the caves, if they don't know why they're down there except to kill things and get treasure, then you're not going to get much interaction with that NPC. So having those motivations, I think, is key to like a guide map for how to interact in character, in my opinion.
With convention one-shots, and this goes a little bit back to something you said earlier, Josh, I very much, with every single one-shot character, you know, unless I'm running a PBTA game, those are a little bit of a different story. Mm-hmm. We'll touch on those later. But every single character I bring to the table has about, a paragraph or two of a background to explain who that character is and why they're with these people. Mm-hmm. I will try and put role-playing motivations. Who is this character? What are some ideas about how to role-play this character? If I have the time for it and I think it'll work, the relationships to the other PCs. Because mm-hmm. I feel those types of things will give people things to hang off of and pull on as their character is playing. Like, oh, that character is my best friend. So, oh, they're in danger. I need to save them. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, now you have the player making an in-character decision for their character based on who that character is. You know, as you were mentioning, Josh, this is something you can set up in session zero, mm-hmm. you know, with a campaign. But for one shots, I like to at least give the players something to go off of.
Something to sink their teeth into. Yeah. I mean, it's a cliche of like actors in Hollywood asking the director, what's my motivation? Right. But it's true. It's like, it's really important.
It's funny because this is not a character that most people would think you even have to get in the mindset of because they're so famous and everybody knows exactly what he wants. But when I've been running Curse of Strahd, there is something that really crystallized to me about how I wanted to play Strahd, because you can say that he's obsessed with Tatiana and, you know, he wants to escape Barovia and all of this. But there is a way you can go where he is like almost like the hopeless romantic, like Gary Oldman from, the old 90s Dracula. Mm-hmm. Or the direction I wanted to go, because when you look at a lot of the things that Strahd does, he is a terrible, terrible person, and you don't want to excuse him for any of that. So I started running him a lot more like Count Orlok from the more recent Nosferatu movie, where he is entitled. Everything is about me, and he is a blight on anything that he touches. He is absolutely terrible. And getting that in mind, this last session that I had with my players, they finally went to dinner with him, and it was so much easier reacting to them and answering things, because I knew exactly how he was going to talk to them, and he wasn't trying to be charming. He assumes everyone knows I'm charming.
Yeah.
Why do I have to be charming for you peasants? You know that I'm the Lord of Barovia. I know I'm handsome, so you need to just step up and, you know, follow the conversation and do exactly what I'm telling you. It was so freeing, because nothing they threw at me put me off my game. I knew exactly how Strahd would answer anything that they were going to say, just because I got that in my head that it's like, this is like maybe 25% Gary Oldman, 75% Skarsgård.
One last thing I'll add on the modeling good role-playing from the GM side of the table is more of a reminder to myself as a GM. When the players are role-playing, let them cook.
Yes. Yes.
It can be very easy as the GM to be like, think you got to keep things moving. You got to keep things moving. And oh no. And all of a sudden there's this silence, and it's because the players are absorbing what they've said to each other as their characters, and they're trying to figure out how to respond. Then all of a sudden I jump in and I'm shoving things forward. Recently, within the last year, one of the most brilliant moments I had as a GM was 45 minutes of me sitting there listening to the players talk in character as they were discussing their situation and what they were going to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
That is like a pinnacle achievement for me, even though I was actively doing nothing in those moments, because it was the culmination of everything that had been set up in the campaign so far and all of the role playing that they had been doing with each other and the relationships they had built with their characters. That's like angel singing on high moment for me. But it's like I had to remind myself, you have to sit back and just let them cook.
Yes. Along the same lines, like as the GM, we have the most control over the pace of the sessions and the story. And the role-playing scene is going to pull the pace down drastically,
mm-hmm.
right? Like in terms, maybe not in terms of like people doing stuff, because like talking back and forth is a lot faster than combat, because combat's always slow. But in terms of like the amount of plot that gets pushed forward, role-playing is like moving into snail's pace. But that is a needed release. You can't have tension at 100 all the time. You need this downtime, this space to give people time to process what they've learned in the investigation, or, you know, heal from their wounds. As a GM, giving them the space to role-play as well. What you said, Ange, not just throwing them into the next encounter, into the next encounter, into the next encounter, expecting them to be having these conversations about how they feel about their childhood while they're dueling with the Knight's Guard or whatever. And that's something that I always try to remind myself when I'm planning a session, like give them time to talk to each other and, you know, be with each other. And like the camp scenes are amazing for that.
This is one of the things you also need to be careful of with one shots. Running one shots is a whole other conversation, different compared to running campaigns, because a campaign, you can always reach a point and just pick it up the next time. But a one shot, you need to get them their beginning and their end with whatever is in between. And sometimes if a group is really into role playing, you know, like you got a group that loves to chew the scenery and interact with each other, you may not get all the in between middle bits you need to get in there. So you need to figure out how to compress that so you still have that cohesive, you know, narrative in the game. And then conversely, sometimes if you have a scenario that relies heavily on the players interacting with each other and the world around them, and your players have no interest in actually role-playing with each other, that's going to turn that four-hour session into a two-hour session real quick.
Chaining off of what we were talking about a little bit before, in that same Curse of Strahd game, when the bard died after the big werewolf fight, she asked me, can my ghost say something before she fades away? It would be really easy to just kind of be annoyed and say, no, we have to keep moving. There's more stuff to say. But I was like, no, there's no way I'm going to say that. And besides, you know, yeah, we have to hear this. And she gave this speech about how she didn't know all of these people when she first met, you know, when they first met up, and how they became her family. So the best thing she could have done is give her life for her family. It's like, we were all around the table crying. It was great.
That's brilliant. Josh, you mentioned combat. Now, combat slows things down. It is very easy when you get into combat to have it just turn into a board game. So how do you keep the focus on role-playing during combat encounters, you know, that are leaning on a lot of dice rolls? How do we keep the role-playing narrative still in there?
The two things I try to do is I try to have every combat have a reason, and that reason shouldn't be they fight them to the death. I mean, sometimes you got to throw that in as a little treat, a little death match. If there is a fight, the fight should be over something, either, you know, rescuing a hostage or acquiring an item or forcing them out of a location, or, you know, there should be something besides just the I'm going to get your hit points down to zero aspect of it that people can lean on, and that'll add more tension to the scene. And there's a whole like discussion about like running combat here, but like the main thing here is that like if there's a tension, if there's a complication that is beyond just getting the other side's hit points down to nothing, then that gives you the opportunity for the characters to latch onto something from their motivations, from their desires, from their history, their backstory. The other thing that I try to do in combat, I don't always succeed because sometimes I just get wrapped up in it, but I try to describe what the NPCs are going to do, not what they're currently doing. I'll be like, Jared, it's your turn. You can see that the Kingsguard are rounding on Ange's character. What are you going to do? This gives you an opportunity to think about the situation, not in terms of positioning, but in terms of your relationship to Ange. And how you're going to react to that, and how you're going to interact with the scene.
Yeah, I think the descriptions are a huge part of making combat actually interesting. You know, it's very easy to fall into, I swing my sword, I hit the thing, and that's not exciting. So it's like you want to add that flavor. And as GMs, we need to model that for what we're doing with the adversaries the players are facing, you know, if we're going to expect that from the players to describe what they're doing, or, you know, how they finish an adversary off, or that type of thing.
I wish I remember where I heard this from, because I am nowhere near smart enough to come up with this on my own. But at one point in time, I heard someone kind of mention that on initiative count zero, reframe where everything is at. Like, just make sure that you touch base on, this just happened. You just cut this guy's head up. This person is still perched up on the wall. You know, you go through everything where it's at now after all the things that happened in the last round. And it does kind of bring it back into, this is a story. These, you know, the numbers did what they did during the round, but now I'm going to tell you where we're at. Now we go into the next round and we go from there. I really like that. I try to remember it. I don't always do it, but I do try and remember that. And I like that idea. Obviously, if your game doesn't have an initiative count zero to do this on, figure out some other trigger. But like, once you go through everything, have that point where you stop and you go, okay, let's reframe what's going on and then move forward.
Yeah, I think almost any game, like, yeah, there are games who don't have a traditional initiative. I'm looking at you, Daggerheart. But even then, you have those moments where, you know, everyone has done something and now the bad guys get to go. Okay, use that as your moment to take that moment to reset everything. Savage Worlds, okay, it's a new initiative order. Everyone's going to get a different card. Take that moment and describe where things currently stand. It's a little easy to forget to do that if you're running online in a VTT where you have the map right there. Everyone can see where the tokens are and what's going on. But taking that moment to add the narrative to it can be really powerful.
One little trick that I like to do for VTTs, most of my games are online, so I've encountered this problem a lot. The initiative tracker, it's really easy to lose track of which round you're on when the initiative tracker is keeping track of everybody's initiative for you. And you can easily slip into the next round without noticing. If something important needs to happen at the like at the end or the start of a round, add in an extra token to represent that so that when the tracker gets to that thing, it's a reminder of like, oh, right, reframe everything.
This is more speaking to mechanically running games, but don't sleep on lair actions. If you are running a D&D-esque game, lair actions are your friends, and you can have them go on. Usually it's like initiative count 20 of the next round type of thing. But it's like, don't sleep on them. They can really add some flavor to things.
And steal them for other systems that don't have them. Like,
yeah.
One of the other things I wanted to point out, and again, this goes back to the GM controlling the pacing. Combats can take a while, especially if you're higher level in a like a D20 style game. Combats can take a long time. Everybody describing every action that they're doing all of the time does a couple different things. It A, slows combat down even more, and B, becomes, I don't want to say monotonous, but unless everybody is like an A to S tier like describer of things, it can probably get monotonous. So knowing when to be okay with just I swing my sword versus when like I do a parry and flourish and then lunge and that, like, it takes practice. It's one of the skills that you level up with, but like not doing that for every single role is not a failure.
Yeah, I like leaning into the critical role. How do you want to do this?
Yeah.
You know, it's like when Matt asks that, you know, the adversary is dead and the player now gets to describe how their character takes them out. I usually ask my players after an adversary goes, what does this look like?
Yes.
You know, and some of them are going to be like, just I stab them and they fall over. But it gives some of them the opportunity to add a little more flair to what that happens without dragging everything down.
I ask that of spellcasters when they cast a spell, especially like the first time they've cast a spell or something like that. I'm like, cool, what's it look like?
Yeah.
Because that gets them thinking about like their style of magic too, beyond just the mechanics of it. And I've had players like not consider it from like when I ask that question, but then B, like really get into it. And like, ooh, okay, this is like golden fire and it represents like the angelic demon combination of the soul. I'm like, okay, yeah, go off, dude. That's great. Awesome.
Of course, nothing is worse than the players. Well, it's got some somatic components, so I guess I'm waving my hands around. Like, no, dude, give me some flair. Give me some flair. So, as a fellow player, do you have suggestions on how to help the other players get into character and roleplay? Because I know if I'm at the table, I want to roleplay my character. I don't want to have to give up on my weird Russian accent because nobody else, the player, is role-playing their character. How do you get them to play too?
We've talked about this before, and I know you and I have done this before, Ange, but like finding someone in the party that your character is friends with really kind of helps with that, because then you're building that relationship. You start having that reason to talk to them specifically, and maybe not even about, you know, like what we're about to do in combat, but just like, you still owe me money from that time that, you know, we went to the bar. And I really like that, because I've done that in other games, not just with you, Ange. I'm sorry, it's not just you, but I've done that in several games, though, where I'll find someone that seems like they would be a good friend for this character that I'm playing. And it's like, it's not that I don't like everyone in the party, but there is that certain like person that plays off of them very well.
This goes into a lot of also how you as a player at the table can help spotlight management. You actually choosing to engage with another character at the table, say, hey, I want to have a scene with this character. I want to have a conversation. Can we role play for a moment? You know, like actually pulling in the other players is a good way to try and get some of that to the table if the other players are struggling with it.
At the base level, you've got to pay attention to the other players at the table and be interested in their characters, and maybe make some notes and remember some things, some details about them. Like, oh, you know, you said you used to be a farmer. What do you think of this weird chicken god thing that we found? Which is actually a conversation that I had in character with another player a couple weeks ago. There is nothing that humans love more than gossip. There are actually studies that show that gossip helps us create community, because it creates like an in-group and an out-group. And, you know, normally there's a lot of sociological things around that. But in terms of role-playing games, gossiping with other PCs is a great way of getting people talking. Going up to like another player and saying, can I just be mean for a second here? Bam, instant, delicious, wonderful. The other thing that I like to do when I'm a player and I'm trying to like encourage other people to role play as well, especially because I don't like hogging the spotlight. I don't like feeling like I'm hogging the spotlight. I want other people to get involved, but that doesn't always necessarily mean it has to be with me. I will have my character delegate. I'll be like, oh, that guard looks mean and I don't want to talk to that guard. So Barbarian, who's been quiet this whole session, why don't you go talk to that guard for me? And it's going to do one of two things. Either the Barbarian's going to say, okay, and go talk to the guard. Great, role play. Or they're going to be like, no, I don't want to talk to the guard. You talk to the guard. And now we're role playing. So it works either way.
That is one of the things I have run into as a player that has become one of my pet peeves. It's like, okay, there's an NPC we need to talk to, and I don't want to be the spotlight hog. So, like, hey, why don't one of you other players, characters, go talk to them? And, like, they're all just, like, looking at me. And I'm just like, I don't want to have to be the spotlight hog. Please, somebody else go talk to the NPC.
I've done that in games where I am not the person that's going to take over and be the face. But I also recognize that there is someone that is continually doing that. And sometimes their character may not even be good at it, but they're just so used to doing it because they're a very forceful personality anyway. And I will have my character kind of like interject and go, oh, wait a minute, and stop them and go, this seemed to be something that you knew how to deal with. Can you step in here before he speaks too much? You know, and then, you know, kind of usher the other player character in there so that you're helping them get that spotlight.
I have that in my Saturday group right now, because the player who can most often step up and do these things is currently playing a kobold wizard with an 8 charisma. And he will look at them and he's like, I'll go talk to him. You probably don't want me to, but I'll go talk to him.
In our Monday night games, we have a wonderful trio of characters, my character, my husband's character, and our friend's character. And the friend and I have the highest charisma stats, and we are essentially the party's faces, but we also hate talking to people in character. Like, out of character, we love it, but like in character, both of our characters like hate talking with people. We're misanthropes. But the problem is that my husband is playing a character who loves talking to people, but he's a big old himbo who has no idea what is actually going on at any point in time. So like, me and the alchemist would be going back and forth, like, you know, you go talk to me. I don't want to talk to you. You go talk to me. Like, you got, well, I talked to them last time. No, you got to talk to them. And then my husband's like, I'm going to go talk to them. And we're both like, no.
This reminds me of, I was running Dragon Heist, and Jarlaxle was one of the main NPCs that could be your big bad in this whole campaign. The players didn't know this was Jarlaxle, but they knew they needed to talk to him. So they sent the two bards to talk to him. The bards were a pair of ginger cats who had half a brain cell to rub between them. And they go in there and they start talking to him, and they're having a great time, and he's charming and they're charming and they're telling him everything. And they leave, and the other players are looking and they're like, so, and like, no, he's a great guy. That was fun. And the other players are like, we made a mistake, didn't we? And I'm like, you guys sent the two bards. I mean, it is what it is. Luckily for them, Jarlaxle wasn't actually the big bad in their run of Dragon Heist.
I think one of the lessons we can learn from this is that it's helpful to create a foil for characters. It's a lot easier to play off of someone, I think, than to come up with something on your own. So if you've got a really stoic, grumpy loner character, playing, you know, a character that's just like right up in their face and be like, you're going to be my best friend now. I don't care if you want to be alone. That sort of idea of giving the other player somebody to play off of is really helpful.
I think it's kind of funny because that made me think, because I've recently been having discussions about like the formative stories of D&D and where things came from and the idea of where adventurers came from and everything. And I think one of the reasons I have always liked Fafford and Mauser better than Conan is because Fafford and Mauser have a relationship. They mm-hmm. play off of each mm-hmm. other. They're talking to each other. They have personalities and they needle each other about things. Yeah. And that's makes it a lot more, you know, interesting than Conan, because even when Conan has someone with him, they aren't equal to him because they aren't constantly with him. It's just whoever's with him for the story.
Let's say you've got somebody actually role-playing their character, but their actions and choices are causing problems in the game. They're being a jerk, but their response is, but it's in character. How do you handle that? Because they're doing what we want. They're role-playing, but they're also being a jerk.
I think sometimes you almost need to explain to them, you aren't just being your character. You are the actor portraying your character. If you were, for example, Tom Holland playing Spider-Man, what decisions would you want to be made about your character that would make your story more interesting, not just what's awesome for you to do right now?
Yeah, there's very much the, it doesn't matter if it's in character. If you are ruining the game for everyone else, don't do that thing. I have actually kind of stopped games, paused games, when things like that are happening. I had a Masks game I was running once where one of the players was just being a dick to everyone else. And she was playing the, I don't remember what the archetype is called in Masks. It's not the troublemaker. It's the, basically, it's kind of the rebel trickster type of character.
Yeah.
But she was basically being a dick to everyone else and like putting illusions on them that were embarrassing them. And I'm finally like, turn to the player she was currently doing this to. And I'm like, are you enjoying this? Do you want to continue with this? And they're like, not really. And I'm like, okay. That player no longer consents to you doing that to their character. It doesn't matter if it's in character. It is no longer fun for anyone else at the table, so we're not going to do that anymore. And I think this was the first time anyone had ever told that player that just acting in character is not good role-playing. You know, it's like you need to support the rest of the table. You need to support the story, you know, the plot that the GM is giving everyone, the stories of everyone else at the table. And no one had ever done that to her, I don't think.
I mean, obviously, it depends on the level of toxicity, right? Like, yeah. Obviously, if this person is, you know, being a complete dick, then goodbye. But also, like, there are others, like, that usually happens at, like, a new table or a con table or you know, at your local game store or something like that. Amongst your table, amongst your friends, it gets trickier because there are other relationships outside the game. Assuming that everybody is acting in good faith, there are things you can do to mitigate the AOE damage, I guess. James D'Amato, in I think it's his guide on role playing, he's got a couple different like role playing guides, but he has one, I think it's specifically about role playing. I forget the title, but if I can find it, I'll make sure it gets put in the show notes. He talks about ways of playing your character that is irresponsible for the character and potentially the party, but not doing it in such a way that it has blowback on the other party members that might not be consenting to your character's actions. So like the example that he gives is like a heist game where the characters are like, you know, one character is supposed to be on lookout looking for the bad guys. And the player decides, well, my character's irresponsible. So even though he's on lookout, he's going to go to the casino and start gambling and drinking at a different table. You know, the other players might hear that and be like, what? We planned all of this. You're supposed to be on. And now, like, all of the bad guys, and like, this is all your fault. What do what you're going to. But you can take a step back and you can say, OK, what is your intention with this? What do you want to have happen here? Why are you making this irresponsible choice? How much blowback is the table comfortable with coming back on them? And you can like negotiate that back and forth. So it'd be like, OK, so, yeah, I want to be irresponsible. So maybe like, I go off, I get a couple drinks, I get like beaten up or something like that. And then I come back just in time to like warn them that the reinforcements are coming. James explains it a lot better in the chapter than I just did in that summary of vague remembrance. But there are ways of assuming everyone is acting in good faith and not just trying to like troll people.
I find if I'm playing and I'm going to make a suboptimal choice that could adversely affect the other characters, I will sometimes go have an above the table conversation and say, hey, this is kind of where my character is at. This is what I think she would do in response to this. Is this going to like screw everything over, or can we figure out a way to like let that stay true and make everything else work? Because you don't want to screw over the rest of the table or the GM's work that they've put in for this game. Whether it's the person who's just on a power trip and thinking they're going to just throw a wrench in the works and go against the grain, and they're just a dick because they can be, don't play with those people. But then there's also the people who, like, they literally think it's the highest form of role-playing to act as their character, regardless of what it does to anyone else at the table. And therefore, you have the GM having to, like, force them into the adventure because they're like, no, my character wouldn't do that. And it's like, as a GM, I'm like, okay, fine. Then you're going to sit there while everyone else goes off on the adventure. It's the reluctant hero trope. You can play a reluctant hero. You still have to heed the call to adventure. Mm. As a player, if somebody is doing this, sometimes it's going to require an out-of-character, above-table conversation to basically figure out what's going on, why they're doing this, and letting them know this isn't okay. Any last words of advice for our listeners on how to get their players to roleplay more?
I used up all of my wisdom.
I don't know that it's all that actionable, but I will say that it is worth it to make someone comfortable enough to help them to find that voice for their character, because there is nothing quite like seeing somebody, especially when they're new to the hobby, and kind of getting that joy of being in character and doing something, even something as simple like, one of my players in Curse of Strahd, when she was very into making her character, she was like, I want to be a half vampire wizard. But, for a while, she was just kind of like watching everybody else play. And then at some point, she started reading her sheet and she's like, wait, I can like crawl up walls and stuff. So she started like crawling up, on ceilings and like shooting things down at people and everything. And she was like, I love this. It was just this idea, like, even when it wasn't tactical, it was just the idea that's like, no, I can do these things. This is great. So it's just wonderful seeing that person light up like that when they realize, like, I can do weird stuff.
I think it is okay as a GM to tell your players what you would like to see from them. I have in my Saturday game, sometimes we have done campfire bonds, and it's a scene between two characters. And I'm like, I want you to role play a conversation. This is not just you telling me that you two chose the same watch and you talked all night. I'm like, give me a conversation. What do you two talk about? And like explaining to your players, you want to see more role playing between them. It's okay to have that conversation. It is also incredibly important to understand that players are all going to be at different levels of this. Some people are going to find that easier than others, whether they're new and they've never done it before, and there's a lot happening in their imagination that's a little hard to get out at the table, to players been playing for years, they're just not comfortable at this. You need to meet everyone kind of where they're at and figure out ways to try and help them get to where you want to see them at your table.
It's funny as you were mentioning that, because Josh had just mentioned James D'Amato. I have here the Ultimate RPG Campfire card deck, 150 cards for sparking in-game conversations. Which is actually a really cool thing if you are having people have that campfire and they don't have a thing to talk about. You can go in here and pull a card and say, does this sound like something the two of you would be discussing?
I need that. I want that. This show is funded by the Gnome Stew Patreon. You too can Patreon backer by following the Patreon link at the Gnome Stew website to the Gnome Stew Patreon. We love doing this and our patrons help us keep it going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network, so if you're enjoying us, here's another show to check out.
Well, if you liked Ange and Jared on this show, you should check them out on Thaco with Advantage, because that's where they love talking about RPGs and D&D. Together, they share insights into the games they're running in the campaign journal, and then they tackle a variety of topics that affect the game in the DM's workshop. They're going to talk anyway, as you've already noticed, so might as well record it, right? Maybe you'll even pick up an ancient D&D factoid about a previous edition of the game that you'll never use.
You can find all of us at gnomestew.com, and then there's various social media out there. Gnomes, is there anything else you want to give a shout out to today?
I wanted to bring in something oddball because there's going to be a Godzilla source book for Marvel Multiverse Roleplaying.
I know they did a crossover, but like, okay, wow.
Yeah, they are doing a Godzilla source book. It is a 64-page soft cover, so it's not the full big hardcover that some of the other source books have been, but it was like, I saw that and thought, I have to get it just because, like, how often do you have a Marvel source book that's all about Godzilla? So, you know, I'm planning on getting that. And I mean, yeah, by the end of this month, there's supposed to be that Secret Wars thing that's coming out for Marvel Multiverse. But I mean, Secret Wars, what is that? Like, I couldn't be tying into anything, could it?
Josh, what do you have for us?
Okay, so about a year ago, some bookish friends and I started a company mostly based on puns. We were at a con and it was really hot, and we were like, wouldn't it be cool if we had fans with book art on them, like hand fans that we could use to fan ourselves with like art from books on it? And ha ha ha, it would be fan art. We started the company. It's called I'm a Fan. The idea is that we match up authors and really awesome artists, and they collaborate and create a hand fan with either art from or in their world. And we are launching at Dragonsteel Nexus in December, which means, unfortunately, you can't buy anything right now. However, we could really use your help on social media. We need to feed the almighty algorithm. So if you could go to imafan.net, go to where we have our socials listed and follow us everywhere and comment and like our stuff, hopefully because you like it, but honestly, just do it because I'm asking you to, because we would be super, super grateful. And then when we do start selling online, you'll get notified. And hey, if you're going to be at Dragonsteel Nexus in December, you can come see our booth where we're going to have all of the fans live.
That is awesome. From me, we had Steve Kenson and Alex Thomas on the Gnomecast back at the end of January talking about Mutants and Masterminds 4th Edition. One of the questions I had was about a character creator for the system, because the previous version was no longer being supported at all, and it's a complicated enough system that having a character builder is super helpful. Just recently, Green Ronin released a version for Mutants and Masterminds 3rd Edition on their website. They will have one coming for 4E, but it's not here yet. So if you're using 3E still quite a bit, definitely worth checking out. Otherwise, keep an ear open, because the 4th edition version will be coming soon. So, you guys think we roleplayed well enough to stay out of the stew?
I don't want to go talk to the stew pot. Jared, go talk to the stew pot for me.
You can't talk to a stew pot. What do you mean?